This episode of AVXL was recorded on July 14th, 2017. We're going to talk about Alexa on your Android TV, VR getting increasingly affordable, a little AV101 with loudness and audio recordings, an interview with the Quantum Dot Masters and Nanasys, and quite a bit more. Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah. Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear. We love stereos. We love headphones. We love music. We have been known to dabble in VR.
And video games,
and
baby.
Video games. Video games on a projection screen with a full surround sound system.
That's pretty glorious.
It's pretty glorious.
All you console game owners, get that 5.1 audio rolling.
Yes. And 5.1.
5.1.
Nothing says video game like a subwoofer thumping you in the skull.
Need the sub.
That just sounds wrong.
I gotta tell you, even a good pair of headphones on a PC, man, for gaming,
it makes a difference.
You gotta hear those details. They put so much work.
Oh.
I feel with modern gaming, they put as much work into the audio tracks on that kind of content as I see even in movies, generally.
Mm-hmm.
There'd probably be some good arguments to hear between those two groups, but I mean, you think about like timed events and mood and everything else. It applies on both sides, so
it does.
And I appreciate it. Audio reproduction.
Oh my goodness! Before we go on a side trip at the low end of the audio frequency scale, let us welcome you to AVXL. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
He is.
I am.
Oh my goodness!
Still.
Kind of a chill week in some ways, kind of a not-so-chill week in others. Amazon Fire, hopefully if you went for Amazon Prime Day, you got something good. I got a coffee maker.
Oh, did you?
I got like 25-30% off the coffee maker I've been eyeing.
Pretty sure I didn't buy anything, although I was eyeballing quite a bit. I did buy a replacement coffee, travel coffee mug.
Very exciting.
I ran one over with a car.
Was it a Prime deal?
No, actually it was not on sale whatsoever, and what surprised me is last week we were talking about a TV we had mentioned that was on a good deal or a projector or something. And then I checked that price on Prime Day sale,
mm-hmm.
and the price had gone up like $300 compared to the week before.
Huh.
And the other thing I noticed about Amazon's Prime Day is that many of the deals for TVs and things like that were brand new created ad placements or brand new created mm-hmm. items. They were slightly tweaked from the regular postings you'd find for a particular electronic device.
Right.
I was mostly looking at TVs. In the case of the TVs I was looking at, there were these special day of created listings, and they were very difficult to track in terms of what past pricing
right.
was. You had to go look for what that individual unit was listed by itself, not the special Prime Day ad on Amazon. So they're aware of how people game that system, and trust me when I say that take your time on shopping for a great deal, especially online, because they know our tricks, and Camel can show you what that particular item is, but if that item is day of,
yeah,
that's all the history you have on it, and it might not be representative of what the best deal is over the full life of that product, so...
It was pretty crazy. I think Wirecutter looked at like 17,000 deals and found 96 or something like that.
That's a good algorithm. There you go.
lots of editors.
I will say the deal on Amazon products,
mm-hmm.
their Dot and their Echo, were the best they have offered to date.
Absolutely.
So, man,
if you didn't buy an Alexa, excuse me, if you didn't buy an Echo, a Dot.
Or a Dot.
They sold like a metric ton of Dots.
I saw somebody who integrated a Dot into their car. And it will never leave that vehicle from this point forward. They're probably using like a mobile data plan or something
sure.
for it. But still, it was like, what a great idea. I may end up throwing the puck up on the dash and leaving it there.
DIY kit.
It's like you consider what you can stream, and if data ain't the problem, oh, that might be the best place. Welcome, Alexa. I'm sorry.
Michael, are you sure you want to do that?
I actually did tell my mom's Echo to do something over a phone that she was just holding on a
right.
loudspeaker and the other day. And it actually triggered the echoes within our own home. So
perfect.
Suddenly I had like three things happening at once. So
as long as
I'm trying not to say the A word, but there you go.
I said it by accident already. I apologize, everybody. If you do own an Alexa device, This week, Amazon started rolling out software for the Fire TV set-top boxes and sticks, so you can now control them via an Alexa-enabled device.
Sweet.
So if you have an Echo or an Echo Dot, you can talk to it and have it control your Fire TV set-top box.
And I just saw over on CNET that David Katzmeier hooked up an Alexa, Amazon Dot. I will just say the Dot itself. He used their least expensive one and was controlling one of the very latest TVs, a Sony A1e OLED that runs Android TV. So I think you're going to see the Android TVs that use that as the TV operating system be among the first that will integrate that voice controller or the hook for it, at least. That's something I've kind of been waiting for, something built in. And as soon as the cable set-top and satellite set-top box manufacturers, all set-top box manufacturers should jump on this immediately. It's just something I've kind of been waiting for, especially for cable set-top boxes that I probably deal with the most. They're very rarely updated with new features. I will say the Comcast X1 platform is probably the most updated thing I've ever worked on in terms of adding new features and abilities and functions, and being for paid services, it's probably the best thing I've worked with. But if I could integrate voice commands with that, and for a user to make it really easy, turn the TV on, turn it off, turn the volume down, mute it, things like that, basic commands would be awesome. And the more they can make that more robust and more usable, the better.
So my understanding, by the way, if you have a Fire TV with a voice remote, right, then you already had Alexa, but you had to hit the button.
Ah.
Now you won't have to hit the button anymore.
Ah, the CIA loves this.
The CIA loves this. Listen to all the things you do. Google Home, while we're talking about home automation. And it's funny because Apple, apparently in like 46 of its stores around the world, or 64 of its stores, has rolled out HomeKit demonstration areas. Because apparently there's a large disconnect between like the app and what you can do with the app. And of course, you know, Apple's always looking for new and exciting things to sell at high margin in the Apple stores. So now
they're getting it up to speed still.
Yeah. Well, you know, yes, I'll just say they are still getting it up to speed. But if you've been curious about HomeKit and you're near one of the tiny smattering of Apple stores that have it, you know, it might be, if you want to see what the Home app can actually do, that's probably the easiest way to do it. But essentially, it allows you to talk to your phone and control the stuff around your house. I bring that up because in the continuing battle between Amazon and Google, you know, Google Home can now play uploaded music. So originally, you could just, you know, play the tunes.
That's almost where I want it.
Almost.
Almost. It still won't play the FLAC files directly off my local storage. I can do it on my phone with Google Play, using the downloaded content on my phone. But as soon as you upload any of that lossless content to Google Play and your own personal account, it gets converted over to something a little more lossy. So
I'm not saying it's the audio file solution.
No.
But if you've been looking at Google Home and being like, I don't want to pay to have a Google Play account when I have this music already.
I have 7,000+ tracks in Google Play. Basically every CD I've ever owned, I've since uploaded a copy of a FLAC file to that, and it's sitting there. And if I can just have that shuffle play on a Google Home device, hey. Win-win. That's closer to what I really want.
I think about the only thing that might tempt me to put
given the speaker quality of a small device like this too, it's probably not such a big deal that it's not my original lossless track, but a conversion of it. So,
well, it's interesting. One of the things that they've been playing around with is I hear that an Alexa voice control beta is coming for Sonos, but I haven't seen it yet. And that's the one that's the thing, you know, most likely to get me to actually put an Echo in my house would be the ability to, you know, be like,
if there's a company thinking about integrating those features,
you know,
Sonos is extremely aware of that.
Yeah. And it would work once they actually rolled it out.
And exactly. They're the type of company that really won't talk about anything until it is really close to done. I mean, or practically finished.
I mean,
they don't want to waste people's time.
And they announced that they would be doing this last August. And then in May of this year, they started sending out invitations to a private beta. So hopefully...
I've been in those private betas. I like the features I get to test.
Yeah.
But still, yeah. All respect to them because they've got the audio quality side down, I think. And if they can just bring voice command to it on popular platforms.
Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of have to at this point.
And I'm aware that you could, like, you know, connect an Echo Dot to a Sonos if your Sonos has a line in. But I don't want to deal with plugging cables into my wireless speakers in one corner of the house.
I do. Integration at some points is really nice.
Oh. So, you know, we talked about the top of the show, VR pricing was coming down. There's a $200 Oculus Rift coming from Facebook in 2018. There's a big announcement this week. Yeah. Well, it's going to be, so here's the, it's not going to be a replacement for the Oculus Rift that connects to your PC. It is going to probably have a fairly high-powered mobile processor, but you're talking about essentially a Snapdragon and, you know, mobile processing level graphics and mobile processing level computation. On the flip side, it should be battery powered. You should be able to put it on your face. And did I mention it's going to be $200, which is probably a sign that Facebook is making money hand over fist. And they're a little frustrated because even with the price drops on Oculus that came earlier this year, and more recently in the last couple of weeks, Oculus Plus Touch controllers are now $399. And, you know, part of me is tempted to buy that because it's so cheap, especially compared to the HTC Vive.
Yeah, and I look at products like Samsung's Gear VR that, yeah. Geez, during that Amazon sale, they were selling an unlocked top-of-the-line S8 with the Gear VR, the newest Gear VR headset, mm-hmm. plus the hand controller for less than you could get the regular phone for normally. And granted, it's your cell phone, and it's using all that hardware built into it and right. the limitations of the display and everything else, but it's it comes with it, and you can try it and get a feel for it and to see if VR experiences are something you want to dip your toe further into. And the $200 price point for a new Rift,
yeah. Well, it won't. It's not going to be one that connects to your PC.
Gotcha.
So it will be standalone. It will probably
somebody will hack that.
Somebody, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, though, it's not going to have the computational power a PC would have. So right now, you're looking at an HTC Vive, $799, and a lot of pundits are out there basically writing that, you know, HTC needs to cut their prices to stay competitive. And the reason that Oculus has cut their prices, or Facebook has cut Oculus price down, you know, with the Oculus plus the touch controllers for $399, is because they have been behind.
I would say yes. Why cut your price on one of the best VR systems out there in reference to the HTC Vive?
Well, they also don't have the kind of pockets that Facebook has.
Most don't.
But yeah, very, very few. Well, I was talking to a friend of mine who develops for VR platforms, and you know, the numbers, you know, one data researcher was saying, you know, there at the end of 2016 there were over 400,000 Vives and 250,000 Oculus Rift headsets.
Which says nothing of the use.
Which says nothing. Well, let's not even get into the use. Just pure numbers, right? And the number that my developer friend had from Epic said 750,000 Vives and 300,000 Rifts at the end of 2016. So a big part of the, you know, a big part of them cutting the prices or, you know, Facebook cutting the Oculus prices because they are trying to gain market share, right? Because HTC has right. that whole steam. HTC got their controllers out faster. You know, the delay on the controllers, I think, really, really hurt the Rift in a big way. But I'll be curious to see where both are by the end of this year and what the prices look like. I would be tempted to buy the Oculus Rift, but my developer friend was also like, you know, I spend a lot of time, I have to recalibrate. He's like, basically says he has to recalibrate his Oculus on a weekly basis, and it's a pain in the
I'm waiting on Gen 2
posterior.
Most of this tech, so I'm not diving into it head first.
It's not a bad idea, and it's not like there's a ton of applications out on VR right now, but it is getting more tempting, that's all I'm going to say. It is getting more tempting and
my
slightly less
PC
expensive.
Gamer heart is warmed by these news items. What can I say?
Switching gears up a little bit, we got a tweet from @FXRScene. Sent out a link to the Hidizs, and it's Hidizs, which is a pronunciation so complicated even I can't figure out.
I'll stick with what you just said.
Hidizs. But he sent out a link to the
Hids.
There's a Forbes Tech News. They got hands-on
Hiddies.
With it. It's an Android-based music player, right? Or the
sweet.
hit his AB200, the next generation Android hi-fi music player. And on some ways, it is next generation if you are using your phone or if you've been using a relatively inexpensive non-Android-based players. But, you know, Astell and Kern make some fantastic Android-based players. Fio's got some pretty solid Android, some excellent Android-based players.
What kind of price points?
Yeah, hundreds.
Okay. Yeah, premium.
Like, $400, $500, $600
Okay.
At the entry price for those. So what makes this the AP200 particularly compelling is, you know, for they plan to sell it. The MSRP is supposed to be $299, and you can pre-order one on the Kickstarter. Of course, it's a Kickstarter for $239. That's with 8 gigabytes of storage. It's got a micro SD card slot.
Excellent.
Yeah, you know, it's a you know, CNC milled aluminum case.
Oh,
USB
okay.
Type C, 3.5-inch touchscreen. They're claiming 10 hours of playing time, which is not spectacular, but again, this is essentially a lot of the, you know, a lot of what you would think of as being an Android phone. So you can, you know, just use an external battery. It's using a pair of ESS ES9111-8C DACs, like one for the left channel, one for the right channel. Ironically, we were at Nanus's yesterday, and ESS, which makes the Saber DACs, was in the building next door.
That was a pleasant coincidence.
It was, yeah. I wanted to knock on the door and be like, hey, you guys working on anything cool?
Well, speaking of which, we have a Nanus's interview coming up at the end of this show.
We do
stick around. We'll talk the latest in LCD tech.
Yeah.
And the parts that go into it, and why Quantum Dot's so interesting. So
yeah, I'll be curious to see what the performance on this is like. It's got a single gigabyte of internal RAM.
Tidal support. So to me, the first thing I look at that, yeah, and it means it'll support every lossless format I'll throw at it as well. At least it has the hardware juice to do it.
It'll also do DSD, which is a know audio. So obscure, even I haven't bothered to find any tracks in it. But so it's got, you know, like two separate crystal oscillators, one for DSD 44.1, 88.2, 176.4, 352.8 kilohertz sampling rates, and the other one for 48, 96, 192, 384 kilohertz sampling rates. You know, so it's
covering
checking all the boxes.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, FLAC, APE, WMA, WAVE, ALAC, Apple Lossless, DSF, DSD, native support for DSD, PCM up to 384 kilohertz, 32-bit, ISO DSD. So they've got pretty much everything you could
want. Anybody still using OGG?
Somebody out there is still using OGG.
I love it. Plays on Android.
Yeah.
So you know what? I'm willing to bet that thing plays OGG.
It's got Bluetooth. You know, the big thing I've noticed with the Android-based players, and actually any of, you know, even if you're looking at like a Fio X1, which if you want a standalone music player and you're not trying to drive massive planar magnetic headphones, one of the best deals out there is a Fios X1 that issued the second generation.
Cool.
It'll play all the standard FLAC-based music formats. They're like $100. You know, and the thing that you get with a $100 player versus like spending 2-3 times as much and getting an Android-based player, one of the more expensive standalone non-Android-based players, is, you know, the speed and the quality of the interface experience.
Gotcha.
You know, the
spend a little more money there.
I don't know if money, talent, time. It's just, you know, there's moments like, you know, every time I see some engineer at Google or some product manager at Google being like, you know, let's just change all the, and they've only done this once, but it's like, let's change the entire layout of Gmail and change the icons for spam reporting, because why not? You know, so it's
a click fest.
It's a click fest.
Just click everything and you'll figure it out.
There's no advantage to a click fest on a handheld audio device though. But
no.
So in any case, there's some inexpensive, affordable ones that are not Android based. And the thing that Android gets you, is the ability to do the streaming formats. That's a big deal. So it's, you know, I'm curious. The pricing, it's, you know, $239 for the 8 gigabyte version, $309 for the 64 gigabyte version. That's, you know, that's like the Onkyo X5, which is running Android 5.1 also. That's $399. Onkyo's DP is like $799. Astell and Kern's Con, which is a fantastic piece of hardware. I got my my hands on earlier this year at one of the trade shows, or at one of the Can Jam shows. That's $1,000. Sony's Walkman NWZ X2 is $1,200. So, you know, price-wise, this is a big deal if you're a serious audio nerd. So,
excellent.
Something worth thinking about. It's a Kickstarter, so that also brings back to, you know, how long is it going to take to ship? Is it going to ship on time? Is it going to be late?
Investor beware.
Yeah. But they've at this point, they had a $12,000 funding goal, and they're over $100,000 now. So part of me thinks that, you know, this was somebody who wanted an Android-based music player but refused to pay, like, more than a quality cell phone price for an Android-based music player.
Understandable.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's people I know who spend a lot of time in Shenzhen. They're like, hey, you know, if you want a tablet you really like, you can go to Shenzhen and, you know, basically pick all the features you want and cut them a check, and then a container will show up, you know,
at
the seaport of your choice.
Oh, dude. The button selection alone in Shenzhen was amazing. Just, you can buy any button you want for any... It was amazing. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, so $239 for the 8-gigabyte version. They have 14 left of 85. And there are 9 left of 50 of the early bird 8-gigabyte AP200 with leather case.
They're going quick.
I don't know if they're going quick, but they're going. So, yeah, they sold out a bunch of the other early bird stuff. But, you know, something worth thinking about if you have been contemplating a standalone audio player.
But if you've been eyeballing something that's in the above $500, there's now things for about half that.
Well, when they ship.
If and when they ship.
So it's something to think about. And, you know, if they can deliver it at that pricing, $300 for that is a pretty fantastic price compared to a lot of the other devices out there.
Excellent.
Completely random note. Have you watched John Wick and John Wick Chapter 2 yet?
Stop asking me! I, you know what? I have a busy weekend planned, but it is... I may have to just rip these and put them on my phone and just sit there and watch them on my...
Are you going to watch Game of Thrones?
Never, actually.
Really?
No.
You've never watched Game of Thrones?
Oh, no.
But you love violence.
Apparently, these dragons support the HBO doings, so I support the dragons and whatever they're up to. But beyond that, I know nothing about that episode. I'd rather play Civ 6.
Oh, man. Game of Thrones Season 7.
I need to get my John Wick on. Yes, I know.
Oh, goodness. Let's see. Today's Friday. Tomorrow's
TV is
Saturday.
Beautifully calibrated right now. Oh.
You should just get
HBO UHD
Go,
Blu-ray player. I've got the discs.
You should just start watching Game of Thrones.
I want to watch that. Actually, I want to watch Planet Earth 2 again. It's another one of those titles where I've looked at scenes within the disc and I haven't actually sat there and watched the whole thing through. So, but what I've seen on that disc is fan-freaking-tastic. It was gorgeous, so I'm looking forward to it.
There's no hobbits, by the way, in Game of Thrones. You don't have to worry about that.
Little people?
No. I mean, there's a little person, but you'd like him. He's kind of like
that's
your spirit
okay.
animal.
Now, I got no problem with little people, man. Freaking hobbits, though? The furry-footed bastards. Just go to the mountain. Get this over with.
I don't know. My wife is beside herself with excitement at Game of Thrones. Because now they're getting past the books.
To be better. Game of Thrones has to be better than the Hobbit stories. That's all I'm going to say. It has to be. It's got to be more R-rated.
Oh, my goodness. Another great tweet we got. We're going to toss this out to everybody under the AV101 guys. Props to Thomas, a.k.a. at TQBF, who tweeted, "This is great," and sent out a link to an article. A webpage put together by Chicago Mastering Service and talks about it. It's probably the best explanation I've seen of kind of CD mastering.
And the changes over time,
yeah.
Historically speaking, in terms of where audio recording was at the beginnings of CD and how the engineers were recording that sound to the disc and what they're doing today in terms of loudness. That was the big one.
Yeah, as things evolved from analog to digital recording and then vinyl being the primary distribution medium to digital, whether you're talking about CDs and then online and then FM radio's desperate need to make sure the volume never changes.
I was going to say, or the marketing people going, can you make this any louder?
And literally, can you make this any louder is what's going on. So Chicago Mastery Service, they do CD and vinyl mastering. Yeah, and they walk you through. It's great because they talk about, you know, sort of relative loudness. And the idea is today so much of mastering is about how can I make the entire song, every moment in the song, be just as loud as every other moment.
And keep in mind, any of those words that end in ness, like loudness, brightness, those are functions that are very personal. It is nothing you can really measure. It is such a function of how you perceive something.
Yeah.
There is no... science. All right, there is some science behind that, but it's not as it's not as a critical measurement as you might think it is in terms of here's an absolute value and it applies to everyone. That's often not the case. So,
well, yeah, I mean, you know, he walks you through sort of decibels, you know, the decibel scale used for digital audio. The
very precise thing you can measure.
You know, decibel full scale or DBFS.
But in terms of how we perceive sound and how they can engineer it to make it sound louder or softer or more dynamic or less dynamic and what the trade-offs are, that Chicago Mastering Service article is a good visual trip down memory lane in terms of where things were, where they are today, and maybe where we should step back and say.
Well, it's, and a lot of it's like there's a particularly awesome section of this for me, because one, I'm a big fan of the Stooges Search and Destroy album. You know, I'm also a big fan of Rage Against the Machine's first album. When Rage Against the Machine's first album was remastered, you know, a completely new 20th anniversary remastering. And the inside scoop from a friend of mine who knows the producer on that album, was that they needed to remaster it so they would keep playing it on radio.
Add the remastered tag.
Yeah.
It's fresh.
Well, you know, so the thing about, you know, Rage Against the Machine, right? You know, it was this very early sort of, you know, metally, rappy or funky, hardcore, you know, wall of guitars.
Oh, yeah.
The band's phenomenal. But it was also recorded at Sound City Studios. Is it Sound City?
I don't know that.
Yeah, Sound City on a Neve console. So it was like recorded in this legendary recording space.
Something you would want to preserve every nuance in terms of the room environment and everything and the people in it and the interaction with the instruments and as good as possible. But when it comes to making things loud, there are certain audio tricks you can do as an engineer that will... You're basically destroying the short story is you're destroying dynamic range in order to achieve loudness.
Yeah. And in many cases, causing the waveform to clip, right? So when you look at this analysis of the Stooges Search and Destroy from like a 1990 CD release, you know, the highest average RMS level is negative 13.9 dBFS. The maximum peak level is negative 1.7 dBFS. And then when you go to the 1997 remaster,
zero being peak.
Yes.
On those measurements.
Well, ironically, on the 1997, and you look at it, right, you know, and you have this sort of like, you know, it looks like a meteor kind of, there's a waveform. There's lots of, the black is the noise in the center of this box. And then there's lots of white below and above it, right? And when you look at the box for the 1997 remaster, the highest average RMS level is, you know, negative 2.58 dBFS. So they've jacked it up 11 dB. The maximum peak level is 0.0 dBFS. It's a black stripe.
They had a great word for it. A tube of sound or a
tube
sausage.
Of sound, a sausage.
A sausage of sound.
So this quote, this box is full, like 11 exclamation points. There's a difference of less than 3 decibels between the loudest average part of this track and the loudest digital word that could be represented as sound.
Right.
This is what we call a true sausage. This record is shockingly loud, but also just shocking. The volume in this case has been achieved with almost constant clipping of the original waveforms, which brings us to distortion. You know, and it talks about compression, limiting, digital brick wall limiting, clipping. You know,
we use a lot of compression in our audio recordings for voice just to make it easier for more people to hear it.
We compress it because
in different environments on different headphones and things like that. But when it comes to accurately reproducing or recording that original sound wave, man, that's the last thing you really want to be doing. You want to preserve that as much as possible to give at least the people with the proper equipment and the senses to appreciate it a chance to experience that as close to the original as possible.
Yeah.
And compression's great for a lot of things, but it can be overdone for a simple effect of making things loud.
In the case of the Stooges albums, you can see where they look at the waveform, and the waveform, there's just huge, it's clipped, it's cut off.
It's one big-ass sound field.
Quote, large amounts of music simply disappear into the non-existent area above 0 dBFS. All these flat lines sound like crunchy, your stereo is broken type stuff. Some people like it. Fortunately, not everyone does yet.
Yeah, and if you have something that's absolutely clipping as well, that you're just losing. You're not representing information at that point. You're hammering it and flattening it. And, anyway.
Yeah. There's also some great links at the end.
Yeah.
WNYC sound check, Drowning in Sound, The Rolling Stone, The Death of High Fidelity, a UK Guardian article on CD sound and loudness.
Nice.
What happens to my recording when it's played on the radio?
Right.
Turn Me Up, a new organization promoting standards for a dynamic range and commercially released recording. I'd never even heard of that group before.
I'm telling you, the digital FM and AM systems I see in modern cars today, that's a nice step up. I'd like to, yeah. I need to dig into what their specs are, if it's close to CD quality or not, but it's definitely better than the FM that I was used to for a lifetime.
Well, it also depends on whether you had FM and a good radio with a good antenna or FM with a mediocre radio and a janky antenna.
But is this true?
But yeah, I mean, basically they're taking the softness out of music. They're maxing the volume. You know, they're making a.
Hey, if you're partially deaf, this is perfect for you.
Well, yeah, or if you want to, you know, but it's.
But you're not experiencing it as intended, I think, by the artist at that point. I think the engineer's taken almost a liberty, and probably under orders from. Studio
from the
record. I doubt the artist is saying, or the record label. I doubt the artist is saying, you know what, you just got to make this as loud as freaking possible.
Well, and that's also, it's funny. I was trying to buy, what was it? Like, I wanted to hear a bunch of the stuff off of Pet Sounds, the Beach Boys album. And I'm not a huge, I'm not a Beach Boys geek. So I didn't know a lot of what was going on. And I started researching, and in some of these classic Beach Boys tracks, they've been like, there's like 23 different versions of the album, or like 23 the track shows up with 23 different albums, and
that's a bunch of them are crap.
A bunch of them have the same title because it's the same collection of songs released by the same album, but maybe three different mastering engineers worked
on
them.
You look at like a Blu-ray remaster of a classic movie where they're so careful about every aspect of the visual and audio presentation and bringing that as close to the original as possible. And then it's just almost the exact opposite with situations like this in terms of, it's painful sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and,
different goals. Really.
Something we probably should have defined in the beginning. When you say dynamic range, right, you're talking about the ratio of the largest, I'm reading a dictionary.com definition, I think, here. It's like the ratio of the largest to the smallest intensity of sound that can be reliably transmitted or reproduced by a particular sound system measured in decibels.
I think of it as like the noise floor as the low end on whatever recording platform you're on versus whatever the peak non-clipping level is that you can capture. And those two.
Basically the quietest, in one sense we're talking about music, it's like the quietest to the loudest volume.
Yep.
And when you take something where it starts out with maybe something, a very soft,
like a cymbal or a hi-hat.
Yeah, they're working on a hi-hat, and then things build
and they drop down.
Well, if you take the dynamic range out and you max the volumes out, you end up with a whack, 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 whack on the ride cymbal, and then,
Or like somebody's trying to whisper dialogue in a movie, and then there's an explosion, and those two things are drastically different ends. And to be able to perceive them both on the same audio setup, it starts with the engineering of that audio track, but it also does incorporate everything else along the chain as well. But.
And there's times when it's like, it's great if you don't want to put on headphones and it's 2 a.m. and your surround sound system is in the room next to the baby. I totally get wanting the whispers and the explosions to be at the same level.
I compress dynamic range in those situations all the time.
I do not want compressed dynamic range on my music because
or
it tends
for
to
people
screw
that have
it up.
Hearing issues where it's difficult to understand or their hearing can be easily overwhelmed. And that's where those compression systems are ideal or very good in terms of making it more listenable. But if you've got the gear in the ears to appreciate it, this is exactly what you don't want.
Well, hey, we want to definitely thanks to Thomas for sending that in, and props to Chicago Mastering Service. That's chicagomasteringservice.com/loudness.html. We got a link in the show notes.
That was a thoughtful article. Good link.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas. That's good stuff. Got a tweet from at Zay Burdo. He tweets at Patrick Norton. Just picked up some Hi-Fi Man AT400i headphones. They are a little underpowered for phone and computer. Best fix? So there are, especially desktop motherboards, high-end desktop motherboards now that have excellent audio sections and pretty impressive amplification for headphones. But generally speaking,
you're looking for a headphone amplifier or a combination amplifier and digital analog converter or DAC, or a standalone player like we were talking about earlier. But let's concentrate on some of the computer slash phone friendly ones. And I asked if Zayberto was looking for one for desktop use or mobile or both, and he said both would be great.
Ooh.
In theory, the HiFiMana HE400i should not be that difficult to drive, right? It's
efficient.
I wouldn't know if I would call it efficient, but it's 93 dB sensitive, 35 ohm load, it's not the easiest headphone to drive, but it's not atrocious.
Gotcha.
It's not like some of the older full size planar magnetics where like there's like I have one of the original generation HE400s, and you know, where normally 50 is about as loud as I want to get on my Astral Incurrent AK100 player. To play those at a reasonable level, I basically max the thing out at like 75. Like the volume on that goes from like 50. It goes from like 0 to 75, and I basically have to turn that up to 75.
Okay.
So they are difficult. That head was particularly difficult to drive.
Takes a little extra oomph.
A little extra oomph. You know, so when you're looking around $100, there's AudioQuest Dragonfly Black, which I'm a big fan of. I hooked that up to a pair of Fostex T50 RPs, which is a 50 ohm, slightly heavier, slightly more resistive load, 92 dB sensitive, so a slightly more difficult load.
Compared to, say, using my phone with a lossless audio track and its headphone jack out, or my notebook that has pretty decent audio, apparently powered by Bang & Olufsen technology, I will say the Dragonfly delivered more volume. I couldn't really perceive if I was getting better audio response on which platform. Overall, just because of the volume increase alone, I was able to.
Right.
I would only listen to the Dragonfly.
I mean, the first time I played around with the Dragonfly.
However, I will say it wasn't loud enough. I couldn't max it out, at least on the system I'm currently using with my notebook, which was kind of odd. I was like, either I'm going deaf. Or
well, you're talking about with the output from the Dragonfly into the planar magnetic headphones, you could not get it as loud as you wanted to.
These are planar magnetic?
Those are planar magnetic. Ah. Those are Fostex T50 RPs.
Yes. There wasn't enough volume for me if I really want to blast it.
It's funny because
I couldn't blast it.
For me, you know, running that.
But it was better than everything else I just tried that I just talked about.
This is good. So, you know, if you have regular dynamic headphones, there is more than enough power in AudioQuest Dragonfly Black to power them. For me, I can get the Fostexes being powered by the AudioQuest Dragonfly Black loud enough that it is no longer an enjoyable experience.
Experience, actually. It was like, you know what? There's no way I can actually shock my system with this setup. But that's, yeah, now I'm cruising over to Costco and getting an ear. Your exam.
It might not be a bad idea. So there's also the AudioQuest Dragonfly Red, which uses a digital volume control instead of an analog volume control, a different DAC.
Okay.
And will run you 2.1 volts output compared to the Dragonfly Black's 1.2 volts.
Is 1.2 considered line out? Is there a spec for line out audio?
You know, that's
out of an eighth-inch mini jack. There's
that's a
question.
Great question. I don't have anything that resembles an intelligent answer for.
Let's do some research on
1.2 that. 1.2 volts or 2.1 volts should be more than enough power out of that. That Dragonfly to drive that should be more than enough. If you're using the Dragonfly as kind of like a DAC / preamp input into your power amplifier, you should be able to easily achieve maximum volume out of your power amplifier. But
understood. But those are an interesting case of headphones then, because they do. I think they compared to, say, like, I now see why earbuds are included with cell phones.
They're easy to drive.
Yes.
And they're cheap.
And they're great. Doesn't matter. You got half a watt coming out of that thing. It's still going to make them sound super loud. So,
and those, I mean, those are, you know, those Fostex T50 RPs, I got the reason I originally
beautiful
got
sounding.
These, yeah. They are. I got those when I first got the JDS Labs Element, because nothing I had, like, I couldn't turn the Element, which has 1 watt of power per channel. Like, there's a tremendous amount of power coming out of that. I couldn't get it up above 3, so I'm like, I'm going to get some planar magnetics and see, you know, if I can get the volume up, you know, get the volume up, use more of the, you know, rotational capacity of the volume knob. But a good place to start, though, AudioQuest Dragonfly Black.
Yeah. That's on my short list.
For me, I can get it loud enough that it is too loud. For Robert, he wants more volume.
Well, I think with the pair of headphones I currently use that aren't planar magnetic, probably aren't as power hungry.
Yeah.
So
if you have a regular set of you know, if there are speakers in your headphones, if you have regular dynamic headphones, the black has more than enough output to make your eardrums
plenty
slam in the center of your skull.
Plenty.
Another option would be, you've heard me talk about this, the Magni, or I should say the Shitfall of Two, which is like another $99. That one has a volume knob, which people love. You know, there's some portable headphone amplifiers. You could take the output from your phone into the portable headphone amplifier from Fio. Those are very reasonably priced. If you want to step up in power, a really great option is the Objective 2, which originally started out as a kit. You can pick one of those up for the $129 from the crew at JDS Labs. They also sell the parts for those if you want to build one. You know, there's the Magni 2 amp from Shit that sells for $99. The Modi 2 DAC. Well, a lot of people pair the Modi 2 DAC with the Magni 2 amp for just under $200 is their outboard. Those aren't particularly portable, but they're great for desktop usage. Again, you've heard me talk about the Element. You can pick that up for $349 or $299. They do B stock. You know, if somebody drops one in the factory, it'll still work fine.
It has a scratch, but otherwise, you know, functionally perfect.
You know, that one has a spectacular amount of power. You know, you're looking at something that can dump like 1.1 watts into a 32 ohm headphone, 505 milliwatts into a 150 ohm headphone, and if you have a massive 600 ohm pro grade headphone from hell, it'll still do like 140 milliwatts into that.
All right.
Which ends up being, I think, like 9.4 volts RMS, which is a tremendous amount of electricity to be running into a headphone. And if you want to take a step up beyond that, if you're like, this is my hobby and I want to spend a bunch of money on it, one of the best headphone amplifiers I've ever heard, Rupert Neve, who designed that, you know, Neve console we've mentioned so many times. So Rupert Neve last year debuted the Precision headphone amplifier. It's not cheap. It'll sound cheap in a minute, but it's $499. And, you know, from a electrical engineering standpoint, it's pretty flawless. A friend of mine who does a lot of headphone testing, his sort of lab headphone amplifier had a glitch, a problem. It broke. And then he measured the Rupert Neve Precision headphone amplifier, and it was actually cleaner than the sort of, you know, lab grade headphone amplifier he normally used.
Unsurprising.
It's a fantastic amplifier. It's $499. Shit's Ragnarok, $1,700. Cavalli Audio is working on some new models. You know, they were typically selling headphone amplifiers for like $5,000-$6,000.
Works of art.
Like everywhere else in audio, you can spend as much money as you want to. You know, but I would start, you know, if you really are concerned about getting a whole ton of power, like the Dragonfly Red is going to be much more powerful than the Dragonfly Black, and they both sound
pretty
awesome.
That, I think, is going to be the one on my short list, just in case if I run into any more of the headphones that require a little more oomph, I think, compared to the regular drivers. The electrostatics seem to do best with a little extra power. If you're half deaf, like I am, apparently. So, or at least all the loudness factor.
That explains why you never turn your head when the trains go by over in the Burlington Northern Santa Fe.
You're not shocked by anything.
What? Oh, my goodness. We were down at Nanosys yesterday.
Hell yeah.
They're the quantum dot company.
They are one of the biggest. They provide that technology for a variety of manufacturers. And we had a chance to talk with Jeff Urich, their PR dude extraordinaire. And we ended up going over some of what the current state is in terms of that technology being used in LCD panels and televisions, what's coming up next year, and then looking a few years out. It's nice to be able to have these discussions with companies like this on their home turf where they're comfortable. We had a chance to check out some pretty sweet demos. Everything from the latest ways of making color filters in LCDs using either the lithography process, or now they're able to actually do this with inkjet printing systems, and moving that light source for all technologies closer and closer to the surface in terms of where the light's actually emitted. I think the takeaway from yesterday in this discussion was that, and you'll enjoy this in a few minutes, but I think one of them that is something to keep in mind is that all of our current flat panels save, I think, I want to say plasmas, if you still have one. That'd be the only exception I could think of. But as far as OLEDs and LCDs go, they all use a color filter, a colored piece of plastic in front of a light source to generate the picture you see.
Yeah.
And getting rid of that is a big deal. Being able to eliminate that component within all these display devices will make them even more wide viewing angled enabled, so to speak. And if you think OLEDs are perfect, look at a grayscale picture or a setup on a OLED and then move left and right. You'll see the effects of the color filter on that system too. It's not as dramatic as an LCD, but still, this was fun. They're a great group to hang out with, and we got a good preview and some good information about what you'll be seeing in TVs this year and next year. And what is the end goal for Quantum Dot in, as far as display systems go? And I thought it was a pretty good conversation overall.
It is. We're going to roll that after the main podcast. I got to say that QLED, there's going to be a lot more light coming through QLED panels soon.
The organic versus inorganic chemistries. We get into a little bit of everything on this, and I think there's something there for everyone, even if you're not the most technically inclined. I think we try to keep it pretty straightforward and well explained. You tell me. Let me know.
Ask at avexcel.com.
Please do. Ping us, folks.
We're curious about what's.
And thanks again to Nanosys and Jeff and the whole crew down there. It was a great day, and we caught them on their corporate lunch day where they were feeding the whole company and. Let me tell you, that was nice.
We like free food.
It's not bad.
Oh, man. So, yeah, full disclosure there. They fed us.
Yes. That was the only compensation.
Well, they fed the entire company. Yeah, we just have to be there on the right day for it. So that'll be rolling after the main podcast. Can you do a 2017 OLED for under $2,000? And the answer is, it's a good time to be looking for a 55-inch television under $2,000. Sony XBR 930E.
That's the most impressive flat panel LCD I've seen this year so far in terms of absolute light output. That's their direct lit system with full array local dimming. Mm-hmm. That 930E at a 55-inch screen size. That's about the smallest screen I absolutely consider anymore for any kind of home theater use.
Yeah.
Given that the bezels on these TVs used to be so much larger, if you have an old 55-inch TV that's more than, say, 5-6 years old, chances are it has a giant bezel around the frame. And honestly, if you could eliminate that, you could probably fit a 65-inch screen. But in terms of 55-inch screen sizes and what's out there right now, no, you really can't do a 2017 OLED under $2,000 right now. That will hopefully change before the end of the year, or a good sale will roll along on those panels. But in terms of what is available at that price point, right at about $2,000 is that X930E from Sony. Amazing picture quality. And in a 55-inch OLED, I'm seeing currently at about $2,300, $2,400. Sale price is currently hitting about $2,200, and that's for LG's own panels. And then if you step back one level on the Sony platform to their 900E that incorporates edge lit instead of direct lit with a limited local dimming, if any, that gets you well down to about $1,300 right now. And I got to say, if 55 inches is the limit and you've got a budget that's in the $1,000 to $2,000 range, it's still tough to find an OLED. But there are some amazing LCDs out there that provide terrific image quality and performance. And I'm assuming the Sony TVs with their Android operating system will work just dandy with the recent Amazon Echo and Dot updates. Try not to say the A word, but... And there you go. I look forward to it. I got to say, if I can't have Roku TV built into my TV, I think Android TV is probably my second choice at this point. So
that's a good choice.
Yeah.
It's a good choice.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Should we do this interview? Get out of here?
We should. Hey, thanks, everybody, for listening. If you are a fan of the show, and we hope you are, do us a favor, go over to patreon.com/AVXL, join in, and let us know, if you are not enticed to support us on patreon.com/AVXL, tell us what we can do there that would entice you and get you all excited about being a part of the crew that supports
you or your friends.
Yeah.
No pressure. Just love to hear from you.
If you got some friends that like home theater and audio and video and they're not listening to AVXL, send them a link to the show, because we're always looking to grow the audience. And we're also looking to hear what you're thinking about. You got tips or suggestions or questions, ask at AVXL.com. It's the place to sell them. We're at Patrick Norton, at Robert Herron, or at AVXL on the Twitters.
Indeed.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to toss it over to our Nanasys interview. And I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.
Hey, we're right now visiting at Nanasys Incorporated here in Milpitas, California, checking out some of the latest and greatest quantum dot technologies. And I'm visiting with Jeff Urich. Jeff, what's your position here at the company?
My title is Director of Marketing.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
And one of the things that Jeff has shown me over the years is just some of the latest updates to what they're doing with quantum dots in terms of display technologies.
Right.
And today we looked at some pretty cool stuff that's kind of pointing the way toward where we're going in the future.
Yeah.
I've often talked about the final stage, or one of the final stages for quantum dot technology, is to become electro-emissive in a sense.
Right.
And I know we're not there yet, but could you go over some of the differences between, say, what we're doing today versus that endpoint goal of actually driving materials with electrons instead of photons, say?
Sure. So I guess probably start from today. We're doing what we call photo-enhanced displays. We basically take a standard LCD display and we use quantum dots to really optimize the performance of the display. So quantum dots are super efficient light emitters and they emit really pure colors. And because we can tune the color of light that they go off, the exact wavelength of light, we can actually match the backlight of an LCD display to the color filters. And really, you know, if you want to nail DCI-P3 color gamut, improve the efficiency, we can do that. We can actually eke a lot more performance out of an LCD display.
Now, every display I'm aware of, at least as far as flat panel TVs go, mm-hmm. use some sort of a color filter.
Right.
Be it an OLED or an LCD,
right.
and what is the limitation with that way of generating color?
Right. So that's, you know, anybody who's ever looked at an LCD, and in fact, even the OLEDs that are shipping today are using color filters. This is like the lossiest part of the system. Any engineer who looks at this is immediately the part they want to change about the system. And basically what you're doing is creating a full spectrum of white light in the backlight, and you're jamming that into color filters, and you are losing 2/3 of the light right away. So it's a super lossy, super wasteful design, basically. If you've ever taken the front of an LCD panel off, it's surprising how much brighter the backlight really is than the light that you're getting through the front of the panel.
Do you think today's designs are really like maybe 10% efficient in terms of the luminance generated versus what actually reaches your eyes?
Yeah, it's something like that. I mean, single digits even. You know what I mean? It's pretty surprising. And they're very efficient displays in terms of the amount of power that you use. And now we have 1,000 nit displays, over 1,000 nit displays. So
for each window in that color filter, then, mm-hmm. is I take it it's super critical to have like the right shade of red, blue, or green.
Exactly.
For a given light source?
Exactly. So you have different light sources in the back. It's like you got to think about, you have a spectrum of light in the backlight, and then you're running that through a color filter to get your end result. So you need to have either really good, for great color and great brightness, you need to have really good color filters or really great backlight. You really want both for an optimal experience.
Is it being able to take, say, for that white light source or whatever the lighting source is, mm-hmm. being able to just specifically allow the transmissivity of a certain wavelength through that one window and limit it to the others, but try to make that as efficient as possible?
Yeah, exactly. So, the original kind of white LEDs spectrum has a really narrow blue peak and this broad kind of yellow peak. And you want red, green, and blue. And so what you end up doing is really kind of filtering out a lot of that yellow light and trying to just get as narrow of a red and as narrow of a green as you can. But if you want really great color, it turns out in terms of designing the filters, you can't have really high brightness and really great color at the same time. The narrower you make that filter, you think of it, it really is in many cases making that filter a little bit thicker. And so less light is getting through and you're getting a more pure green, but you're getting less and less light. So that's where quantum dots come in today, because we can make exactly the red, green, and blue that you want in the backlight.
And currently the materials are being used in terms of transferring or converting one wavelength of light or one type of a color of light, say,
yeah.
into another specifically.
Exactly. So we take blue light, short wavelength blue light, and blue is the highest energy wavelength, or that end of the spectrum is. And so we take that and we down convert it into green and into red. And we do this depending on the size of the crystal. So quantum dot is an amazing actual, it's actually nanotechnology. They're a little bit bigger than a water molecule, kind of in the size regime of a strand of DNA.
Right? Wow.
They're incredibly small. And
tiny.
Yeah. And they're little, they're semiconductors. They're little crystalline semiconductors that we grow. And semiconductors are energy converters, basically. And so these little semiconductor crystals absorb that blue light. A blue photon will strike a quantum dot, kind of charges up the quantum dot, and it burns off a small amount of the energy, and it spits off a different color photon. It makes a brand new photon, spits off a different photon of a longer wavelength. And the larger the crystal, the more energy it burns off, and the longer the wavelength you get. So larger crystals emit into the red, smaller crystals green, and you can even go into blue.
I would assume that the number of photons, say, striking the surface of that impregnated material or whatever it is that contains the quantum dots, is there an estimate of how efficient that is in terms of the lighting that hits it versus, you know, like I say, if I'm shining, you know, 100% on one side of a full spectrum or whatever that light source is, what could I expect in terms of quantum dot generated light coming out the other side?
So quantum dots are really efficient. I mean, the best materials we make today are over 99% efficient.
Okay.
So you put 100 photons in, you're going to get 99 photons out, more than 99.
Getting
photons.
The photons to that spot might be the bigger challenge, or directing all that energy appropriately. But.
Well, one of the cool benefits of this, it turns out that blue LEDs are actually the most efficient LEDs that we have today. So they're an awesome source to build on top of. So the best LEDs we're seeing today are around 60% efficient. So in terms of converting electricity into photons. And so
I imagine for binning those LEDs too, it becomes critical to get, what are they just shooting for on the blue that comes closest to what's in the spec for, say, Rec 709 color or HD color? Are they really just trying to, or are they just simply trying to get it the most saturated possible, almost as close to like a single wavelength, laser-like, coherent light?
Right.
If you can think of it
that way. Blue are very narrow emission spectrum. They have under 20 nan or about 20 nanometer full width half maximum, and that's a measure of the width of the peak at half of the height of the peak, which is very, very, very saturated, pure color. And I think most of the blue LEDs were, the thing that was driving blue LEDs is actually white LEDs. And a white LED is really a blue LED with a phosphor cap on top. Typically, we're using a material called yttrium alumina garnet, which gives off that broad yellowish spectrum that you see if you look at a white LED. And so the white LED market was basically driving the investment and improving the efficiency of the blue LEDs. I might be wrong about this, but I think that the YAG phosphor really liked around a 450 nanometer pump source. And so the choice of color, I think, was driven maybe a little bit by the color standard, but also by the phosphor.
That's interesting. And we were talking about basically the different ways of stimulating quantum dot materials, and currently it's done with LED light sources, generally speaking.
Yep.
We were looking at some demonstrations, though, of where we're going to material being stimulated by electrons, and if you could just talk a little bit about the advantages of that and
sure.
And how that compares to what we'll be seeing maybe next year.
So yeah, as you said, kind of the end goal of this is to get to an emissive quantum dot displays. And you can think of this very much like an OLED display, except quantum dots are an inorganic material. So it's a different kind of a chemistry.
What are advantages between, say, inorganic chemistry versus organic chemistry in terms of, at least in lighting systems?
Right. So the organic materials are typically they're much more volatile, and they want to react with things a little bit more. So, you know, people probably know that OLEDs are very sensitive to oxygen and moisture, and quantum dots really don't have as much of an issue with that, orders of magnitude less. And so if you put a pinprick hole in your OLED display, I think you'd see that it would die pretty quickly. So you need to really protect those materials, and they're just a little bit more volatile. And so inorganic materials are a much more stable, robust system.
So previous designs I've tested and looked at incorporated either a tube along an edgelet system in front of an LED lighting source that contain the quantum dot materials,
yep,
or a sheet that replaces a diffuser or other component within the LCD itself.
Yeah.
What's coming next?
So, yeah, exactly. We actually developed both of those approaches. We ended up going with the film approach in the long run because it was a much more efficient system, and it was actually easier for the TV makers.
Wasn't that really like they could take out a diffuser layer and just substitute that in and with the right... go through it again, make sure the colors are where you need them to be and things like that. Was it literally an iterative process like that to make it work?
It was, yeah. I mean, that was one of the big, you know, our current CEO, this guy, Jason Hartlove, he joined Nanosys in 2008, about a year before me. And he came from this, he's a real product guy. So Nanosys was actually founded in 2001. And the company had been doing a lot of directed research on all these different types of nanotechnology. Quantum dots are one of the founding technologies in the company. Actually, people thought it would be used for solar at the time. And so a ton of research going on. And Jason came in and he has this real product background. He's actually one of the guys who helped develop the optical mouse.
Duh.
And it's kind of an interesting case study. That technology was originally going to be like a $1,000 handheld scanner, right? And there's not a huge market for that. And he looked at it, hey, this is really great at positioning, right? And so maybe we can make this billion selling product out of it. And so he kind of brought that kind of perspective to the company. We had this great technology, and you can go to the display makers. You've seen the glowing vials of quantum dots that we have. It's really cool. And we can go to those guys and say, look at these cool glowing vials. And they go, awesome. You know, it's not their job to figure out how to integrate that into the product. They weren't going to be motivated to do that. And so we spent a lot of time looking at how displays are made and learning from the LCD display makers, you know, where can we fit this into your product in a way that you're not going to have to change your manufacturing process. And there's something like $180 billion in capital capex in the ground for LCD manufacturing. And so those guys have these depreciated fabs and they're cranking along and they don't want to really change the process. So our first idea was the tube of quantum dots you mentioned, but that was just a little bit too much of a change for those guys. They had to really change the process just enough. And so we really worked hard to develop the film and make it just a true one-for-one drop-in.
That's spectacular.
Yeah.
And looking forward, we've seen announcements recently about moving, instead of a filter within the TV, moving the source or the materials itself that contain the quantum dots closer and closer to the surface.
Exactly. And that's where you really want to be. And that's where we've always wanted to be, but there were some big challenges, you know, in terms of making the quantum dots processable. So that film technology that we use today, that's a kind of homogeneous mix of red and green in this slurry. They're just blended together at random and coated on this film. And so there's no real patterning there. It's just this very simple coating process. It's kind of the beauty of that system.
Hopefully it was blended well
exactly.
Before it gets spread on.
It's all part of how it goes. But, you know, you want to be at the front of the display. And for exactly the reasons we talked about before, you know, when you look at the way the filters work, you're losing 2/3 of the light at least at the color filter. And so, gee, if you can take the quantum dots and pattern them and replace the color filters, and so that they're not color filters anymore, they're actually an active emitting layer, and you could actually double or triple the power efficiency of an LCD.
That's fantastic. So that translates directly into either what, something like you could reduce the power consumption by half, or you could double more so the brightness.
Exactly. It gives a display designer a lot more flexibility. So what do you care about? Do you care about battery life or the power coming out of the wall? You can cut that in half. Or do you want to double your brightness? If you've got a 2000 nit TV today, do you want to go to 4000?
Yes.
exactly. Or somewhere in between. And so that's really, really useful.
And so then by being able to pattern this out, though, on a color filter, that part of the mechanism in an LCD, then I imagine that gives you more precise control then over the red and how much red and specifically. You're not having to mix that with a separate color and then hopefully it all blends nicely as it comes through. This is really where you can then focus the materials in specific regions for the subpixels and go from there.
Exactly. So, looking at this, every pixel in any display really today is typically made of red, green, and blue subpixels. And you mix red, green, and blue to make whatever color you want to create. And so quantum dots, again, going back to the beginning, they're tunable. And so, you know, what red wavelength do you want? You know, I think can't think of it off the top of my head, what the red for DCI-P3 is, for example, or BT-2020. You want a 620 nanometer or a 630 nanometer red. we can easily make that. So it's that's totally open now.
For me, visually, it's like finally you're able to see something like Ferrari red on the screen, or yeah, some of those ocean scenes in the Caribbean with just that amazing blue color that it's always been truncated on all previous displays up to the point where we have these wide color gamut systems.
Right. Yeah, people immediately jump to the red, green, and blue, the primaries, but I think actually like cyan is a great example. Oh. That Caribbean water, you know, color is something.
I'm a big fan of yellow too, so if yellow. We can get red and green out there.
Hey, yeah, exactly.
A beautiful yellow always pleases me.
Yeah.
So going beyond that then, we've now moved the materials into the color filter itself.
Right.
Well, so still using a blue backlight?
Still using a blue backlight, still using a blue pump source or backlight, we would call it. Yep.
So you'd be able to then what? The blue subpixel is clear.
It's just clear.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, you put some scattering material in there to help improve the viewing angle, but yeah, basically clear. And
with the emissive nature though, being able to do at least the red and the green subpixels in a display like that, integrated into the color filter with the quantum dot material, how does that improve off-axis viewing?
So the off-axis viewing in a display like this is awesome because the quantum dots are now right at the surface. They're like kind of the last thing in the stack. And so, you know, one of the challenges for LCD has always been viewing angle. I mean, you think LCDs are relatively thin, but every kind of subpixel, it's almost like this long kind of bazooka tube, and you've got the photons, you know, are coming out in a very, basically coming straight out of the set, right? And so it's very hard to kind of spread out that viewing angle. But now if you've got the emitter layer right there, and quantum dots, one of the neat things about them is they're what's called isotropic emitters. And that means when a blue photon hits a quantum dot, the quantum dot will re-emit a new photon randomly in 360 degrees. And so you've got quantum dots now right at the front of the display, basically spraying photons.
Nice. I imagine that just creates a more even output, less hot spotting in a sense, or sparkling, or just a consistency to that light that you just wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
Exactly.
And as we were talking about color filters on OLEDs too, that's one of the things a lot of people don't realize is when you look at something like a grayscale on an OLED display, and if you move off axis, you will see distortions because of that light having to travel through that layer. Mm-hmm. While it does phenomenally well off axis, it's something that LCDs have struggled with. And I think being able to move at least a couple of those subpixels to be emitters very close to the front of the screen, I think it just sounds fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's a huge benefit. And the other thing is the color is actually more pure because they're not filtering the light. So when you open the green subpixel, on a display with the color filter, well, whether it's an LCD or an OLED, you're actually getting some leakage from the other parts of the spectrum, right? One of the best examples is the blue filter. Oftentimes you open the blue filter, and if you look at the spectrum, you're getting some green leaking through, and it's pulling your blue point off. Closer to the green. And so
that's now, what's going on.
Yeah. And so now you don't have that. You open the blue. Well, there's only blue in the backlight. You open the green and you're absorbing all of that blue and just down converting it into green. And so you don't have that color filter leakage. And so you can get much more pure color. You can really think about doing BT2020 color.
Cool. In terms of manufacturing now, you were showing us a demonstration earlier of a inkjet printed color filter.
Yeah.
Optimized for white point just by resizing the subpixels and things like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of creative in a sense where, you know, hey, what if you just wanted to make a sheet of glass with the emitters printed on it, so to speak, and then be able to fine tune it like that. What other methods do they currently use for building this material into a color filter?
So there's two different approaches. And this is, again, just like we did with the film, we wanted to really go to the industry and see how are you making filters today. If we're going to replace the color filters, as we said, this is a really, really complex supply chain, and you don't want to come in and be demanding that there's some huge changes in the process. It's not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
So we really went to the display makers and looked at how are you making color filters today. It turns out they're using this photolithography process where they put down one color and they kind of etch it off and then they put down the next color. And so we really wanted to make the quantum dots compatible with that process. And so we had to kind of develop a new chemistry that would be compatible with the photoresist materials that they're using. And then We also had to make the what we would call air processable quantum dots. So quantum dots have some sensitivity to oxygen and moisture. But we went to these fabs and you realize you can't ask these guys to put the whole fab under a vacuum, right? They're not going to be walking around in spacesuits and all that stuff. So so we had to improve the stability even more of the quantum dots so that they could process them just in open air. That's a really big thing for the cost of the devices.
Compared to OLED materials currently, I know that at least within the sheet itself, if it's if the quantum dot material is impregnated that way, it actually does protect it, though, in a sense. It keeps it airtight.
Yeah.
How much more sensitive or less sensitive is it, say, compared to what current OLED technologies
are? So OLED technology, I may be getting this a little bit off.
I mean, I go back and I remember some of those very early OLEDs I looked at, like Sony's XEL1.
Yeah.
And anybody who still owns one of those has noticed that it just turns slowly yellow over time.
Sure.
And longevity issues.
Longevity issues.
So that's one of the things I look toward quantum dot to be a forerunner, or at least something to help get us past that stage.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's a definite thing. The OLED materials, there's a spec that we use in the industry called water vapor transmission rate, WVTR, and the OLED materials require a barrier that is, I think, 10 to the minus 6 in terms of allowing water vapor transmission through the barrier.
Pretty tight.
Very
restrictive.
Yeah. Quantum dots are less than 10 to the minus 3. So it's orders of magnitude less. And so even on the films today, we're able to use stuff like what we would call like a food grade film. So, you know, you can think of like a saran wrap kind of a level. So, you know, there's some protection there, but it's not an sort of extreme level of protection.
Could be more cost effective too, I assume, down that road.
Exactly.
Now, looking down the road, say in the next year or so, I probably can't talk about who's manufacturing what, but will we see these displays by the end of this year, or is it more like we're looking toward a demo maybe for next year, or perhaps shipping products?
Well, so it's hard for us to say because we're the kind of chemistry guys. We make this, you know, material that goes in another component that goes in another component, so we don't have a lot of control over this. But what we're hearing is that this could be something you see as a demo next year, perhaps shipping at the end of next year. So it's pretty exciting. This is a lot closer than people thought that this technology was. I think this has been the dream for a long time for quantum dots, and you know, like we talked about, there were some really big challenges to solve. And so it's pretty cool to see it coming to market really soon.
And then for looking out to the more distant future, at least, one of the devices I've seen before, but haven't really been able to take a picture of it or describe it, was just the electro-emissive, in a sense, where you're stimulating quantum dot materials with electrons directly, not using light, but energy, and then having it directly emit a light. That to me is beyond fascinating, especially when you can combine that with something like inkjet printing. It opens up a world of possibilities. And today I was just pleased as punch to actually see an updated demo of that. Being able to apply energy to that material and see it emit a very bright light and very robust and controllable. So
It's a really exciting area. It's still kind of in a research phase. So,
totally.
You know, I don't know, maybe in that kind of 3 to 5 year time frame before we really start seeing products. But we've made really great progress on that stuff. And so, it's going back to what quantum dots are fundamentally is, they're energy converters. And so you can pump them with photons and you can also pump them with electrons.
Beyond display systems, do you guys have any other strong focuses that take up at least as much time? Or it's something, we are in that field you might not have been aware of, or either for commercial lighting or I don't know.
Yeah, so we're actually really focused on displays. We think displays are the best, application for this technology. But when you go to the emissive display, I think that's where things get really, really interesting because the way that we're making those displays, we're going to be able, step back a level. I mean, there's a kind of through line here from the technology we have today, the next generation replacing the color filters. Now we're going to be able to make patterned quantum dots, right? And we're going to be able to do that in open air, ambient air. And the electro-emissive technology is all being developed using printing techniques. And so these have the potential to be really low-cost displays. And, you know, OLED has been talking about this for a very long time. They'll tell you, we have no backlight and all that. And so the cost is going to be less. But they're using these very very complex evaporative techniques to make the displays. And so you have to have the display inside of a vacuum, and it's very costly. It's very, very complex. And so I think we can actually deliver on that promise and be able to make these displays using real printing techniques. And so you could have, yeah, very low cost displays. You can start to imagine that world where you're shopping for your TV, you know, in the wallpaper section at Home Depot and all that stuff, you know.
Without a doubt, if they can come up with a flexible technology or just large sheets that you can apply and do what you like with. And
right.
Could be a fascinating future.
Yeah, and you get into some, you know, Minority Report stuff where you've got the cereal box that's talking to you and all that. So, yeah.
When it comes to mobile devices, is it pretty much the similar challenges that you deal with in large format displays like televisions? The usage cases are different, but is it usually just more of a focus always on power consumption and achieving optimal brightness and
power and thinness? And so, you know, one of the interesting things for me was, you know, quantum dots can really improve the efficiency of a device and the color, of course. And so the first time I went to a meeting with somebody developing a mobile phone, the quantum dot, the film today is about 200 microns thick. You've picked it up. It's pretty thin stuff. And so going in and saying, hey, we've got this really thin film, and to the phone designer, that might as well be a mile thick, right? I mean, they're like, are you kidding me? So, and then on the other hand,
thin enough.
Right. So, we haven't seen the current version of the technology really penetrating like the down into phone sizes. For tablets, no problem. We've shipped a few different tablets, notebooks, monitors, TVs, obviously. So those next versions of the technology where we move into the filter or the electroluminescent version of it, that we see for sure as a mobile opportunity.
What about competition with other competing technologies like wide color gamut LEDs, white LEDs? There have been some red enhanced LEDs now that are doing better red and a wider gamut. And how do you see the technology that Nanosys creates? Like, is it considered a premium version of that, or is it something you guys could say, hey, it's just an option and we can be price competitive, or what?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so the LEDs definitely do continue to get better. It's no longer just the basic kind of yellow YAG. You can kind of boost your red spectrum a little bit, and there's some new phosphors out there. So that's kind of what I think of as.
I mean, I go back to the old school RGB LED TVs like Sony's XBR 7, I think it was, back in the day. It had actual RGB LEDs that an incredibly wide color palette well before DCI in the home and things like that.
Those were the first LED TVs. I mean, then they really had, exactly, three colors of LED.
And you were wondering how they did such beautiful color. That's how they created a robust white light that way. But
And so that's what quantum dots are actually kind of bringing us back to, that really true tri-color RGB. I think they called it triluminous at the time.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Well, or that name is simply carried on.
Yeah. So. Those technologies continue to improve. Quantum dots definitely do have some advantages because we're color tunable. And so these other materials are kind of limited by the emission spectrum of the material itself. So they're not flexible. It just, you get the red you get, and you still have to pair it with a color filter and try to get the right color. And you also get interesting things happen when you have different materials. And so in those LEDs, you're actually mixing a couple of different phosphor materials inside the same LED. And so you run into some of those challenges. And I think actually those original LED displays had this challenge too, which is the colors decay at different rates over time. And so, you're losing your red a little bit over time versus your green and things like that. So,
does Nanosys currently work with any LED manufacturers in terms of incorporating that technology instead of phosphor style
into
coatings?
The LED?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is an interesting topic. I mean, that's been a hot topic for a long time. People call it on chip quantum dots, right? Going right on the LED chip. And, you know, I don't know if we'll really see that take off for displays, because I think from a thermodynamic perspective, again, in a world where you've got the quantum dots patterned on the front of the display, is it worth putting them in the backlight in the LED? You could save a couple bucks by having even less material, and that's kind of the goal there. But it's still a hard problem to solve. Living on an LED is a really, that's a tough environment.
I want an inkjet printer now that'll print quantum dot materials out for me so I can create some really cool just plexiglass signage with some blue LEDs on it. Anyway.
Yeah, totally.
I want a sweet exit sign.
We could. That's a market we can look at.
We'll be active matrix, at least in my workshop, but not yet.
Yeah.
But that's terrific.
I am looking forward to next year just to see what some of these technologies can bring, because right now, I'll be honest with you, it seems the OLED folks, with their ability to do deep dark black mm-hmm. and that relatively wide viewing angle, it gives them a significant advantage, I think, in visually speaking for the premium market, at least in terms sure. of televisions. But what has shocked me most of all this year is seeing value, good, strong value TVs, 4K, HDR, wide color gamut, using your technology and yeah. similar technologies to deliver this improved color rendering, color expression to just people on a budget.
Exactly.
So it's not the super premium anymore, and it quickly seems to be becoming a checkbox feature. You're just going to say, does it have wide color? Oh, it doesn't? No, not that one.
which is mind-boggling to me, because, you know, we were out there kind of shouting into the wind, you know, 5 years ago, color matters, you know, and almost nobody's really paying attention. And then all of a sudden, it's just been awesome to see the whole industry from the content creator side to the TV maker. I mean, the whole thing, the distribution channels. So it's just... it's an awesome time to
that gives buy me a quick reminder. We were mm-hmm. talking about at least when I first learned about quantum dots and some yeah. of the original chemistries involved, it was all cadmium based,
right.
and apparently as a toxic metal and certain restrictions in certain countries, and people want to move away from toxic systems.
Yeah.
But has that changed? I mean, are they still used in certain applications?
Yeah. So the analysis, we actually make all these different varieties of quantum dots. So
okay.
We started with cadmium quantum dots. Actually, from our founding, we've really been working on all these different variations. So cadmium free, and we also make a hybrid material. So that combines both. But it was true for a long, long time that the cadmium materials had a huge advantage in terms of performance. They were far and away better in terms of brightness and in color accuracy.
Easier to work with.
I mean, they were some of the first materials that people worked with. They were a little bit larger. I mean, believe it or not, in this world of, you know, nanotechnology, you know.
One atom or two.
Exactly. I mean, so you're thinking, really? Is there a big difference there? Yeah, there is, because exactly what you said, you know, when you got
the whole point of how color is generated, it's a size-based thing
yes.
for the quantum dot material. So larger goes toward blue.
Larger is red.
Larger goes yes. towards red, smaller goes toward blue.
Yeah.
And now I'll have that straight in my head.
Yeah. And so, yeah, when you've got a smaller material, you know, plus or minus one atom.
Size control.
As a percentage becomes big. And so it's even more challenging.
Don't want your green or red or blue drifting off too far.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's the whole benefit of the technology. So, but that gap has really, really narrowed over time. Again, people were more used to working with the cadmium-based materials. And so it took a little while, but the efficiency of today's CAD-free materials is almost the same as the cadmium materials, which is incredible. It's really incredible to see that.
For what you've seen in this lab environment, what's like the highest percentage of color coverage you've seen in an LCD display, prototype or production?
Yeah, prototype. We did. I think it might be a record for an LCD, which is a 93.7% BT2020 coverage too, not just area, but true coverage.
So, nice.
Yeah.
That well exceeds DCI. And,
yeah, well beyond DCI. And so,
what are the biggest challenges there in terms of getting the color gamut further extended?
Well, that was a traditional LCD design with color filters. And so the challenge there is dealing with the color filter.
It always goes
leakage.
Back there?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, with BT2020, it's even more exacerbated because the wavelength of blue and green that you need are actually very, very close together now. So Rec 709, there's kind of a nice amount of space between your blue, green, and your red primaries. And so the filters don't have to be that precise. And in fact, they weren't designed for super narrow emitting quantum dots in BT2020. So you've got a relatively wide blue filter, and now you've got this really, really short wavelength green, and a lot of that's leaking through the blue filter. So you open up the blue, you get your blue, but then you're getting a significant amount of green leaking through. And so it's challenging to work around that.
So for as long as we're going to be using color filters, it's really that combination of working with the engineers building those systems and giving them the materials and having them come up with these designs that minimize the problems we've just talked about.
Yeah. So we did some modeling. I mean, I think you could, with quantum dots and, so what typically happens with us is a TV maker comes to us and they say, here's the color filter that we have.
We are using this.
Yeah, this is it.
And we have a million of them.
What can you guys do with that, right? And so we can tune a spectrum. It's like, well, do you want maximum luminance? Do you want maximum color coverage? You know, something, usually something in between, right? And so we can actually go, you know, look, if you took your red, you push it over a few nanometers deeper, you know, you get this much more P3 coverage. Your luminance would be this way. And so, but if you could actually optimize both the filter and the quantum dots, we think you could get to 96-97% coverage of BT2020 with standard, you know, LCDs today.
A good excuse for me to go buy that Dolby Vision version of Lego Batman that was authored in 2020 for the Dolby Cinema theaters.
Yes.
One of the few movies I'm aware of that was that way. I'm not even sure if the disc is in 2020 or not. It definitely DCI, but I think it might be in there. I gotta go check.
I would love to see that. I mean, there's a few
the content is here. We need these colors.
We need the colors. We need the displays to do it now. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Jeff, thank you so much for your time, and I really appreciate a tour of the facility and for showing some cool future tech.
Yeah.
And I think the audience appreciates it too.
Cool. Anytime. Thanks.